following on, we sort of saw that perhaps it might be useful to do a perturbative analysis in this Randall-Sundrum model, but that kind of brings us more generally to the question of gravitational perturbation theory. Now, this is really useful in GR because finding exact solutions is actually kind of hard, and we sort of essentially exhausted the ones of primary physical interest. However, many of the situations we find ourselves in are very close to something exact and idealized. So in the solar system, our solar system is, we can write in some perturbative way as expansions around either around Newtonian gravity, or in essence, our gravitational field is very weak in an absolute sense. Our sun is way bigger than its Schwarzschild radius, and we're quite a long way away from it. So perturbation theory is very useful from the solar system perspective. I mean, it's absolutely essential in cosmology because our universe has structure, but it's not, the structure doesn't seem to be highly specialized. It seems to sort of be quite random and distributed randomly around us. So the universe is looks like it's sort of very symmetric to leading order, but with some local structure. So again, that's really set up for perturbation theory. And of course, gravitational waves, they're also described quite well in perturbation theory. So the idea is, we perturb around some background solution. Now, annoyingly, the notation for the metric perturbation is HAB. So that's kind of annoying because we've been using HAB as the first fundamental form, but it's kind of useful rather than keeping writing delta GAB, because of course, when we looked at delta G, we were actually thinking of delta G inverse. So whichever way we do it, we're sort of having a slight notational sort of fudge here. So when we did the gravitational action, we found what the perturbation of the connection and Ricci tensor were. So just as a reminder, so we found the perturbation of the Ricci in terms of the perturbation of the gamma, and the gamma is just given in terms of covariant derivatives of H. So here, I've been very scrupulous in ordering my covariant derivatives. In other words, I've kept this grad C out front. So when we see this repeated index here, this divergence, we'd really like to have this covariant derivative right next to the H, because it sort of makes sense. Then it's sort of just, we can replace, you know, our covariant derivative here. The grad A is just acting on a covector, which is the divergence of HAB. So what I want to do is I want to swap the order of differentiation to kind of clean up this expression. But if I swap the order of differentiation on a tensor, I have to use the Riemann identity. I can't just flick this order at will. So I use the Riemann identity to flick the order of differentiation there, and that gives me now a whole sort of set of Riemann terms. But you see that these two here in this column, they're just Ricci's, and these two are actually the same. So I get so I've kind of tidied it up a bit, and you see you've got the wave operator, the D'Alembertian acting on your perturbation. You've got two geometrical terms, a Riemann and a Ricci, and then you've got this divergence term, which I've kind of cleaned up and packaged together into this H bar, which is just H minus HAB minus a half HGAB. So we write this as just we sort of package it in terms of what we call the Lichnerowicz operator, which is the spin 2 wave operator in a curved background. So you're used to seeing the D'Alembertian as the wave operator, but often you're working in flat space, a flat background, when you do field theory. If you work on a curved manifold, you have to actually take into account that your background is curved, and the higher spin field that you've got, the more extra pieces you actually find in your wave equation. So that's our wave equation for gravity. So now we have to decide how much of it represents physical degrees of freedom and how much is gauge, because of course we know we've got this group of general coordinate transformations, which is kind of big. So the Riemann piece is obviously physical because that's a geometrical piece. The Ricci piece is also physical because that's geometrical. The only thing that we've got in our targets as being uncertain about is this last piece, this H-bar piece. Is that something that is also contributing to the structure of the wave operator or not? Because if I set my background to Minkowski, the middle two terms go, but the last term doesn't. And yet I would expect my wave equation in Minkowski to be just box something equals zero. Okay? So coordinate transformations are generated by vector fields infinitesimally. We just sort of shift a little bit along a vector field. So under a small perturbation, so I'm assuming this is in some sense small, The change in the metric components is given by the Lie derivative of the metric along the vector field corresponding to the coordinate transformation. So unless you have a killing vector, a coordinate transformation generates a perturbation in G, at least in the components of G. So this is a gauge perturbation. It's not physical, but it's definitely a perturbation in the context of the components GAB. Okay, so now we see that if we change coordinates, we get some sort of HAB. We get a change in our metric components. So let's ask what this H-bar term is. So the H-bar, our H is the Lie derivative of G with respect to psi, which is just the symmetrized covariant derivative of psi, and therefore its trace is just the divergence of psi. So GAB here is G naught. I'm just sort of dropping the zero for clarity. You don't really need it. And so this implies that my divergence of this H-bar So when the grad A hits the first term, the first part of this symmetrize, it gives it a box psi. I then take the reverse order, which gives me the second term, and then I then take the gradient of this last term. But notice these two terms here are just a commutator of covariant derivatives, so I can use the Riemann identity to reduce those to just the Ricci term. So this is my curved space wave operator acting on a vector field. So this is a well-posed differential equation. So I can solve that if I put this equal to, say, if my divergence of H bar was not originally zero, I would solve this differential equation to find a psi to cancel it out. So I can always choose a gauge in which this divergence vanishes. So this is known as the de Donde gauge. So now in the de Donde gauge, my Lichnerowicz operator is just D'Alembertian, Riemann, Ricci. So it's got all sort of geometric parts. So I can then solve it and find solutions for HAB, but then I have to ask the question, is there any remaining gauge freedom? Thank you. Well, as Remain Engage Freedom, if we have a coordinate transformation, so shifts along a vector field chi, such that chi sort of satisfies the massless wave equation itself. So, yes, there is remaining gauge freedom. There's the gauge freedom chi, so that, you know, this holds. So what I have to do then is I look at solutions for my Lichnerovich operator, and if the h chi, or the, corresponds to chi satisfying this wave equation, then it's a gauge solution. So here, I have, because this is, these are D equations, I've got D solutions to those equations. So now let's count what we've got left as degrees of freedom. So H was symmetric tensor. So that has D into D plus 1 over 2 components. So just taking H on its own, you might think you had D into D plus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom. However, we've chosen a gauge, which is the Dodonda gauge, and that is D constraints. So I can't choose my H totally at random. It has to satisfy these constraints. So I can use these constraints to rewrite some of these components in terms of the others. Finally, I've got chi, remaining degrees of freedom, which is also D. Remaining degrees of freedom. So if I sort of ask what's left, I'm left with D into D plus 1 on 2 minus 2D physical degrees of freedom. So that brings me to D into D minus 3 on 2. Physical degrees of freedom. So this tells me the physical solutions, the number of physical solutions to the Lichnerovich operator is given by D into D minus 3 on 2 in D dimensions. So if D is 4, this gives me 2 degrees of freedom. D is 5, I get 5, and if D is 10, I get 35 degrees of freedom. So it kind of shows how many degrees of freedom and you've got and how fast they get multiply as you go up in dimensions. So in D equals 4, we have a, we can sort of visualize very easily what that is. So we've got, if we have a one of these solutions, it's two, you know, its main feature is you've got the D'Alembertian. That's the feature that doesn't change even in vacuum, I'm sorry, in flat space, you've got the D'Alembertian. So that carries with it a notion of something propagating at the speed of light. So that means you've got a given direction in space, and therefore you have a sort of perpendicular plane to the direction of propagation. And so in that, you have 2 degrees of freedom. And so these correspond to 2 polarizations. And so in two directions, you have a cross or a plus. So we have the fact that a spin 2 wave is quadrupolar, and so our plus takes a circle, first distorts it along the y-axis and then along the x-axis, whereas the cross kind of distorts it. So that's plus and cross. So if you had a ring of particles with one of these gravitational waves passing it, the ring would distort, it would sort of wobble in and out, but along given principal axes. So one is the plus and one is the cross. So it's exactly sort of analogous to the polarization in electromagnetism, except there you've got just vertical or horizontal.
What about in the other dimensions, 5, 10, does the graviton, does this perturbation also correspond to a spin too?
Yes. Yeah, so it's the same, it's just then, you know, we have, you know, in three spatial dimensions, we have a very, kind of a very good visual reckoning of what the polarization states are. So in five dimensions, you've sort of got like two of these plus and cross polarization states in sort of separate planes, and then you've sort of got some kind of cross polarization state. It's just harder to visualize what it is when you go up in dimensions.
Okay, for d is equal to 3, I see that there is no degree of freedom, but
yes.
What about 2?
Well, this is, right. So this is all sort of assuming, you can't really go negative, right, with degrees of freedom. So in essence, what we're assuming here is that our Alechnerovich operator makes sense, right? So if we were in three dimensions, for example, our Riemann would be completely specifiable in terms of our Ricci, because there are no proper, and it sort of ties in with there being no propagating degrees of freedom in three dimensions. And so it's still okay to use this counting argument in three dimensions, but once you kind of get out, now this was asked in previous year, and there was a nice answer to it, which I'm just not quite remembering. So if you're, let's see what goes wrong in 2D. So I think one of the other issues in 2D is it's you can't simply use this counting. It's what it's boiling down to, and I think it's because there are other constraints that actually there's sort of a. Is it that there is a sort of collapsing in terms of the gauge constraints or in terms of the remaining gauge freedom? In one case, one of those arguments is modified once you go down to two dimensions. So this counting argument doesn't work. I just don't quite remember which one it is. So, but I can try and sort of find it offline for you. Okay, so that's gravitational perturbation theory, at least setting up the formalism. It's also demonstrating kind of how gauge is actually an important issue and how choosing the right gauge can sometimes make things easier. So in the usual discussion of gravitational perturbation theory, you kind of use this de Donda gauge because you want to kill off that last term in the operator. But if I return now to Randall-Sundrum, I said that I could always choose that gauge where I had the extra dimension orthogonal and measuring proper distance. So this, I said, was the Gaussian normal gauge, GN. So I have that on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, I have this picture of the background solution going to a wobbled wall, and a wavy bulk. So I had to kind of merge or make sense of these two pictures. So if I was only interested in perturbations in the bulk, I would take the de Donde gauge and then solve in the background. But because I want the wall, I have to be a little bit more sneaky, because I want to have my wall at z equals zero. So my background, my G naught, Randall Sundrum background, or G naught, was this metric, okay? So that's this one. I then wobble my wall and wave the bulk. It's intuitively, but what I really want is to keep in this Gaussian normal gauge. So in other words, I need to set take the wall and straighten it out. So what I'm doing here is I'm moving that to there and this like this. So this is my f of x mu. So I'm doing a translation in my z coordinate to make the wall flat again. So if I ask, what would delta GZ mu be? It's the Lie derivative of psi. So I don't as yet know what psi mu is, but I'm going to assume there is one. And this must be zero. That's how I know there is one. Because if I shift my wall back to being at z equals zero, I have to translate, I have to add an f here, and that means that I have a derivative of f here, so I've got to have a psi mu to cancel that off. So my gamma mu nu z is just the derivative of the warp factor with respect to z times delta mu nu. So all these second two terms give me is a very simple equation for the z derivative of psi mu. And so that's the sort of solution of that, or the particular solution. So I could also add, if I want, another field that just depends on x, because that doesn't necessarily give me a problem. So, actually, what would I want? so then what I can do is I can show that my perturbation, H mu nu, has the following form, where this thing so I have something that actually satisfies the Dodonda gauge. In fact, it more than satisfies it. It goes a little bit beyond. It's transverse as well as divergence, which is, sorry, it's trace-free as well as being divergence-free, which we say is transverse. So I can massage my perturbation. Remember, if I hadn't cared about where the wall was, I would have had the Dodonda gauge and I would have then worked with the Lichnerovich in the Dodonda gauge. Because I have the wall and I want it to be at z equals zero, I have to do this little shift in the z coordinate. I have to do a corresponding shift in the space-time coordinates to maintain this Gaussian normal gauge. But once I've done that, I can remain, the rest of my perturbation sort of stays in this Dodonda format. So I can split my perturbation equations up into something that sort of acts on the transverse trace-free part, and then these extra terms. So the Lichnerovich has a ZZ component, a Z mu component, and a mu nu component. And so that gives me three different equations of motion from the perspective of the brain coordinates, a scalar, a vector, and a tensor. So the scalar component, the ZZ, so what makes, the reason why you usually want to get rid of this piece here, if I look at my Lichnerovich operator and just think about what does it do in this background. In the bulk, my Riemann and my Ricci are very simple because it's the background solution and I have ADS. Ricci is proportional to the metric. Riemann is proportional to combinations of the metric. So these parts become very simple indeed. The problem is this bit. This is now got, you have to sort of sit there. You've got to work out the divergence of that H bar. You've got to remember to trace over all the relevant indices, remember all the relevant connection components, and then do the sums properly. So that's a bit of an algebraic, grudge, sort of long haul hike, right? It does take a bit of work. That's why people usually want the Dodonda gauge to save doing all that effort. Here, though, we want to maintain Gaussian normal because that kind of keeps track of the physical degrees of freedom of the system. So I'm not going to go through all those algebraic steps, but I just want to let you know they exist. And so you have to do all this in order to end up with these equations. So this A, if you remember, is the exponential warp factor. So this is what the ZZ component of the Lichnerovich gives. So the Dodonda bit of my perturbation doesn't see this. It doesn't notice this ZZ equation because its trace vanishes. However, we know that from the right-hand side, the other side of the Lichnerowicz equation, the delta RAB side, that RZZ is going to have a component. There's no TZZ, but there is a parallel energy momentum component, which is localized on the brain, the delta function. So RZZ contains a trace of T. So if our energy momentum on the brain is not trace free, then there's a source here. And so we couldn't just have the de Donda gauge. We have to have something else. But fortunately, we've got something else. We've got the F. So what this means is that matter on the brain induces brain bending. And the magnitude of the brain bending is simply given by equating these two sides here. So I think that's, if I equate those, I get the d squared f is minus 8 pi g over 6 t lambda lambda. So that tells me what F is. Then I look at the other components. The mu z doesn't actually give me any particularly new information, but the mu nu Lichnerowicz gives me an equation of motion for the transverse trace free part of H. So in essence, the mu z part of the Lichnerowicz operator kind of is something that you just sort of is taken care of by the F terms and this equation of motion that you already have. And then you've kind of used those already to simplify the left-hand side of the Lichnerowicz here. So if you sort of look at that, we're not going to do the algebra, but just to sort of see where are those terms coming from. So here, the wave operator acting on HTT, if I look at the background metric, I've got a warp factor times eta mu nu. So the wave operator is simply going to have 1 on A squared times the four-dimensional wave operator acting on H mu nu. So that's the first term here. Then you've got to figure out what else is going on. So you've also got a dz squared piece from this. But then you've got all sorts of A primed on A's and A double primed on A's coming from the Riemann and Ricci terms. And so those all can be repackaged into that second term. So that second term is just a repackaging of all the other stuff in the Lichnerowicz equation. And that's sort of where you have to kind of go through the algebra to just convince yourself that this is really delta R mu nu, sorry, minus a half delta R mu nu. No, minus two. It's delta R mu nu is minus a half that. So that is why you get this right-hand side, because delta R mu nu is going to be 8 pi g t mu nu minus 1/3 t times g mu nu. So this here, this is what's sort of coming from the delta r mu nu. And notice this factor of 3, which is because we are in 5 dimensions. So our source term here for the transverse trace-free part of H does not have the required tensor structure. So that's kind of slightly worrying, but the story isn't finished yet. So what we have to do is we have to actually look at what the full solution is for our perturbation, because it isn't just the H, it's also the F piece. And so if I look at waving hands a little bit, if I look at what the F piece is, the F piece is dependent on the trace of T. So here we would simply say, well, F is the Green's function times this integrated with this T. H transverse trace free is the Green's function integrated with this T mu nu, being a bit dodgy here. But you've kind of got to add the two together. And so this 1/3 here is not the final story. So when, if we want to solve, because I was saying we want to check what do the perturbations look like, the gravitational waves. So we need to construct solutions. And so what we usually do is, of course, we Fourier transform. So I'm simply going to take some polarization tensor, which I'm essentially going to use to get rid of the tensorial structure, because we're in flat space, so you know there's no connection components. And so here, these are my eigenfunctions because of the warping in the z direction, and this is just my standard momentum decomposition of the graviton. So the M is something that's going to tell me about the mass of this thing in 4 dimensions. So if I act with d squared on htt, I get p squared or minus p squared. And I'm just going to identify that with m squared. And so the eigenfunction that I get from the z part of this equation is going to be dependent on that M. So what we have to do, if our remaining... we solve the to construct our propagator, we solve the homogeneous problem, which means that we set t as 0. But we have to also have our boundary conditions at z equals 0. And what remains, if I look at the z component, This is what I end up getting. So what this now is a straightforward Sturm-Liouville problem. And so I can actually solve for these eigenfunctions. So I now just redefine, just changing variables. So usually when you're sort of finding out what are your, you know, you usually write e to the ip dot x because your background is flat, and so ip dot x is just a standard Fourier decomposition of flat space. Here you've got the warping in the z direction, so that changes the spectrum of the eigenfunctions in the z direction. So this is the work you have to do. But by going through this process, you find that these eigenfunctions actually have quite a straightforward form because this is a Bessel equation. Okay, so I've just sort of jumped to what they are. Here I have applied the boundary conditions at z equals 0. At z equals 0, zeta is L. So this sort of tells you what the form is for the eigenfunction to have the right behavior, the right jump across the wall. So now we can construct from our eigenfunctions, we construct the propagator. We're nearly there. So this is, if you, now that you've got the full spectrum of eigenfunctions, you combine them into the Green's function, And I think the reason I wanted to write it out was to kind of emphasize how this splits into something purely four-dimensional and something that depends on the extra dimension. So here, this thing, apart from the warp factors, looks like it's something that's independent, apart from the a squared of z, of the internal dimensions. So if we ask, what is a perturbation in the brain due to matter on the brain, we need we set our z and z prime to zero. And we can write our propagator in the form of a massless propagator and mass, a sort of whole integral over a continuum of massive states. And so that tells us that we can find our HTT consists of a zero mode piece plus something that is dependent on the massive modes. So it looks wrong, but of course this isn't the full perturbation. Our full perturbation has to take account of F, and of course, this F satisfied again another massless wave equation. So here we then end up with the right tensor structure in our leading order piece. So this is another way of accessing the fact that gravity is four-dimensional on the brain. It also shows how the leakage into extra dimensions is occurring. So we have our extra, here I've just sort of been interested in looking at perturbations on the brain from stuff in the brain, but I've got the general set of solutions. So those eigenfunctions tell me how things can leak off the brain. And so, for example, if I ask what is the result of a localized source, the leading piece I get, so I do this integral over m at z equals zero, and I kind of sort of take the leading fall off at large r, I find that the correction to my Newtonian potential is now power law. So often when you see sort of an effect of extra dimensions or effect of some extra interaction, you'll sort of hear that the correction is more like a Yukawa type of correction to the gravitational interaction. It's some sort of exponential. Whereas here, we find it's a power law, and the reason is, for each of these massive wave functions, so normally the profile of a massive wave function is like 1 over r e to the minus mr, right? But you're integrating over a continuum of them, and that's why you get this power law effect. So this is kind of just illustrating an example of using perturbation theory to solve actually quite a difficult problem, because what we're trying to do here is to put something on the brain and see what happens to the space-time. So our generals, we now have a prescription for finding the general perturbation using the Green's function anywhere in the space-time. We also have a prescription for finding how much the brain is bent, and it actually turns out the brain usually bends in response to matter. And what we're finding is that we get primarily 4D gravity, but we have this continuum of what we call Kaluza-Klein modes, even though this isn't Kaluza-Klein theory. So we have a continuum of massive gravitons as well as our massless graviton. So this is sort of an example, one example of perturbation theory. So I'm sure you'll be seeing other examples of perturbation theory when you do the strong gravity course. But this is, at least I've kind of tried to pick out the key steps in the calculation. So, and almost perfect timing.
Mm-hmm. So, if you put other kind of matter in the brain, mm-hmm. does it stay stable under perturbations?
So, is the brain is stable solution?
Yeah.
So yes, because when you're doing this, what you've done by finding this spectrum of solutions to the homogeneous equation is you found the complete set of eigenfunctions, and an instability would show up as an imaginary frequency. So in other words, an exponential growth. And there's no sign of an instability for this particular brain. Again, if you have a different solution, you know, there's all sorts of different brain world type solutions. Again, at each point, you have to go and do this perturbation analysis. Now, one of the reasons it's relatively simple is because the background has these flat brain slicings. And so your Lichnerovich operator really, the tensor structure of it is essentially irrelevant, and it reduces down to things like scalar equations. If your background is different, or maybe something else about your brain is different, you don't necessarily have that simplification. And so then you have to go through again and actually worry a lot more about, is there a mode that can maybe give you problems? So, so not only are these nice and regular, if you then input them back into the Lagrangian to ask, well, what, you know, if I had these modes, what would be their effective action? You'd also find that that was nice. It would have a proper sine kinetic term and a proper positive mass. But things can go wrong if you put the brain, embed it differently, so that, you know, have different boundary conditions, if you keep, you know, the wrong side of the bulk, if you have a different bulk. So, you know, it's a good question. Stability, well defined. It's sort of a case of some of it's a background question, and some of it, as in an embedding question, and some of it's a sort of model question. So, yes?
This calculation telling you that gravitational waves don't decay as 1 over r?
You mean the, well, so gravitational waves don't necessarily decay depending on what form they have, right? A planar gravitational wave doesn't decay. Like, well, you're thinking, is gravity a 1 over r squared force? I mean, it is from that. It's primarily a 1 over r squared force.
For example, light,
yeah?
Three dimensions, when
it's 1 over r squared, yeah.
1 over r squared, yeah. But if you were in, like, bigger dimensions, it should be, like...
So this is... So the massless part of it is, because here's your 2gm on r, mm-hmm. right? So the massless gravitational wave will propagate at the speed of light and have your 1 over r squared yeah. sort of intensity fall off. The massive modes, of course, don't... I mean, obviously, you don't expect a massive photon to... have a 1 over r squared fall off, right? The reason, so that was when I was talking about this Yukawa fall off, the exponential fall off. So you would normally expect an exponential fall off of massive modes. The reason you don't get it is because you have this integration, this continuum, all the way down to m equals 0. So it is a bit peculiar that way.